The sermon that I preached last Sunday was described by some of you as a hatchet job on David. You were mostly quick to reassure me that you weren't saying I was wrong, but just that the popular public image of David took an almighty battering when I described him as a rapist. In a way, it would be interesting to explore that response, because if I had just said that David was a murderer, no one would have batted an eyelid. Everyone accepts that the story says that. I wonder what it says about us that we have been able to reconcile David as hero and David as murderer, but we still get thrown if he's accused of further crimes. I'm not going there tonight, though, because the biblical story has moved on and the preacher needs to move on with it. And besides, one of you made the hatchet job comment in the context of saying that you couldn't wait to hear how I was going to address David's repentance after that. And that is indeed where the story goes to tonight, David facing his crimes. We don't need to make anything of the fact that the prophet who features in this story happens to be my namesake. Those of you who are named John or Peter or Mary encounter your namesakes in the Bible all the time without needing to make a big deal of it. We only notice it with my one because he doesn't come up very often. And so that's enough said about his name. There are a few things in tonight's reading that do deserve or even demand at least brief comments before we get to explore David's repentance in detail. The first is for those who might still be feeling that last week's hatchet job was overdone and perhaps unfair on David. Perhaps you're still more persuaded by the conventional romantic view that this was an adulterous but mutual love affair and not rape. We'll take note of the story that Nathan uses to unmask David's actions. He does not say that the rich man fell in love with his poor neighbour's lamb and seduced it into coming over for the barbecue. The lamb is not a love-struck willing party to its own barbecuing, I can assure you. No, the lamb is an innocent victim, violently seized against its will. This is how Nathan depicts David's crime. And the Hebrew text uses exactly the same word for the seizing of the lamb as it used to tell us that the palace guards seized Bathsheba and delivered her to the king. The second thing to mention is that there are a couple of elephants in the room in this story. And while I'm not going to focus on either of them, I want to at least acknowledge them with a brief comment. One of them was a little bit hidden from us tonight by where the lectionary chooses to end the reading. But many of you will know the story and so be aware of it, and we would have only had to go another verse and a half to trip over it and hear the prophet say to David, "Now the Lord has forgiven your sin, you shall not die. Nevertheless, because of your deed, the child that is born to you shall die." What kind of God would pardon the guilty party and kill an innocent baby instead? The short answer is not the God made known to us in Jesus. We do know that evil doing has generational consequences. Coming generations are going to pay the price for our generation's failure to do enough to halt greenhouse emissions. Serious domestic violence and abuse often has horrific consequences for several generations. The Hebrew scriptures, however, accurately preserve a record of an era that believed that everything that happens is the doing of God, and that therefore any such consequences are punishments willingly inflicted by God. But our trust in the Bible is not in each and every passage in isolation. Our trust is in the unfolding teaching of the Bible with Jesus as the interpretative key. And Jesus quite explicitly refuted the then common belief that all suffering was divine punishment. through his own suffering, he showed us that when suffering is inflicted, God is always and only on the receiving end. The second elephant in the room does segue into our main topic. It's the question of whether David gets off far too lightly. Is his repentance even vaguely proportional to his crimes? Or is this just another case of the wealthy and powerful managing to get off far more lightly than the poor and under-resourced? The question is quite justified and it can't be fully answered. David admits he was wrong, but what is recorded of his confession only refers to his sin against God and makes no mention of his human victims, Uriah and Bathsheba. And in our justice system, even the most thorough confession in the world does not earn a full pardon for murder and rape. It probably didn't for anyone else in those days either. So we're probably just going to have to live with this elephant of inequality. And if you or your loved ones have had your world shattered by rape or murder, that is not likely to be terribly much comfort. All I can do is say, I hear your pain. I recognise these questions. And I apologise for not addressing that properly in this sermon, but if you want to talk with me about it, I won't avoid them then. And you know, most of you know that I've preached on that before. The question of whether David's acknowledgement of his own wrongdoing is adequate is more complicated. Did he properly acknowledge the harm done to his victims? Well, we can't know. If he did, it's not recorded. And that rightly disturbs us, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen. Last year, our church received a letter of apology from someone who had perpetrated abuses here in the past. It looked quite genuine, and we hope and pray that it was, but it didn't name the victims or the wrongdoings. It just said, I'm sorry for everything. So it was impossible to know whether our respective perceptions of everything were on the same page. David's confession is a bit like that, but not quite. His confession does come as an immediate response to a very specific accusation, and so that does give it some real content. And we can make some judgments about his genuineness from what we know of his subsequent life and career, but it still leaves it feeling a little incomplete and unsatisfying. Now we're getting to the heart of where I want to take us with this story tonight. And I think that if we're tempted to cast too much doubt on the sincerity or adequateness of David's confession and repentance, we should at least pause to reflect on how surprising it is that it comes at all. Major political power brokers do not often fess up to wrongdoing on any scale. David could easily have silenced anyone who had the dirt on him, just as he had done with Uriah. There are a number of other prophets and whistleblowers in the Hebrew Scriptures who stood up to kings like Nathan did and who were promptly jailed or killed for their troubles. The same thing today can result in political murders too, or in other cases in relentless social media campaigns denouncing all the allegations as fake news and all the reporters as enemies of the people. Unqualified mea culpas are very, very rare from very powerful political leaders. Nathan's approach was carefully calculated to get around David's power-drunk defences, but the risk was still huge. Fortunately for Nathan, the strategy worked. He didn't march straight in and accuse David directly. Instead, he tells a parable purporting to be a report of a case that is being brought to the king for judgment. An anonymous rich man holds a spit roast and doesn't choose an animal from his own huge flocks and herds, but seizes the one and only beloved pet lamb of the impoverished family next door and barbecues that instead. The description stirred up in David the kind of compassion and outrage that we wish he had felt earlier. He explodes with anger against the callous perpetrator in the report, particularly condemning his complete lack of compassion, all the while completely failing to see his own glaring public hypocrisy. Now, unless David's outrage is just posturing for an audience, what we call today virtue signalling, then his gut-stirring anger at the injustice is at least some evidence of the remnants of a moral compass. His arrogance may have swamped his self-awareness, but he can still recognise and be horrified by ethical failures in others. But right at the point where David assumes the role of judge or moral guardian of the community, Nathan delivers the thunderbolt judgment. You are the man. You are the perpetrator. Driving at home, Nathan follows up by kind of channeling the anguish of God in what sounds like one of those, "After all I've done for you," lectures that come from parents who feel betrayed by the bad behaviour of their children. "Why did you do it, David, after all I've done for you?" It seems that when we turn our backs on God and behave abominably, God takes it personally. "Why did you do it after all I've done for you?" The answer to that why question is complicated, though. It's complicated for us as it was for David. We, like David, are often blind to any real awareness of what we are doing. Powerful men like David are often blinded by a belief in their own importance, their own uniqueness. Surely someone like me, who does so much for the people, deserves a little slack, a little comfort, a little self-indulgence, and a little shelter from troublesome journalists. Most of us don't have quite such delusions of grandeur and omnipotence, but we get blinded by other aspects of the culture around us and the self-protective instincts of that culture. With our consciousness heightened by the hashtag MeToo movement, most men that I know have realised that there are things in their past that now look pretty questionable, but which at the time seemed perfectly normal and appropriate in the culture that we lived in. Having our eyes opened is a painful and terrifying thing. In our weekly prayer of confession here, we confess that we are entangled in sin. And it's true. Sometimes we sin because we make calculating, corrupt decisions. But more often, we are helplessly entangled in systems and worldviews and cultural perspectives that blind us to the ways our actions impinge on the lives of others. We can become participants in horrendous evils without even realising it. If a modern-day prophet comes pointing the finger at me and telling a parable about wealthy people whose televisions and mobile phones and jeans roll out from supply chains full of child slavery and sweatshops and rape of the earth's resources, I'm going to have nowhere to hide. Like David, I might be able to recognise my own guilt and still not be able to name the victims, because these structures of evil deliberately keep me in the dark. It's all too easy for us to point to the sins of the wealthy and powerful celebrity types. Such public condemnations are often necessary and entirely justified. Public crimes need to be exposed and condemned in public. But beware of doing a David and exploding in rage at the sins of others while remaining blind to your own. When the prophet declares that our lifestyles, our comfort, come at a great price, and that this price is being paid by the poor and the broken of the world, will we have the humility and integrity to acknowledge our guilt and strive to reconstruct our lives around new visions of compassion and justice and loving care for the least of these? Facing up to David's sin and facing up to our own sin can shake our world to its foundations. We instinctively want to keep the world neatly divided into good and bad. And we want our heroes to be unambiguously good. It helps to reassure ourselves that we too are good people and that we have earned God's love and protection. But one of the things that this story tells us is that no matter how much we want to view the world in simple shades of black and white, God does not carefully vet the moral suitability of those who are blessed to be used in God's mission in the world. Spectacular sinners like David and ordinary but hopelessly entangled sinners like us are both gathered into the divine mercy and love and no differently from one another. When that happens, and we recognize ourselves there, the invitation to us is the same as the one that we see David responding to as his story continues to unfold. We are invited into the often painful, sometimes tragic, but exquisitely beautiful journey of becoming fully human. A journey from the sort of inhumanity we see in David's calculated and callous crimes to the growing humanization that we witnessed earlier as we sang David's more extended confession with the words of Psalm 51. God is always calling us back to integration, to integrity, to a place of healing where God's generous mercy and love can heal us and restore our undivided selves. We've glimpsed it in the way that David's story unfolds after this event, and we've tasted it more fully in the ministry and teaching of Jesus. It is Jesus who has shown us that the worst atrocities that we can commit cannot forever entomb the love and mercy of God. It is he who calls us to be the change that we long to see in the world by beginning with genuine, heartfelt repentance for our blind complicity in the corruptness that bereaves and impoverishes the world and its peoples. And it is Jesus who beckons us to behold a vision of a new world raised from the ashes of our deluded self-righteousness, and to humbly but joyously welcome that world as it comes dancing towards us on the love song of the Spirit.